Welcome to the RCP Medicine Podcast Health Inequality Series, where we aim to provide you with an insight into aspects of health inequality and provide practical tips to address these issues and food for thought for you to take away. I am Dr. Rohan Mehra, an RCP Clinical Education Fellow and an Infectious Diseases and Microbiology Registrar. And today we will be discussing the LGBTQIA+ communities and highlighting some of the challenges they face, specifically with regards to health inequality within their communities, and what you can do to help address these. Joining me today to discuss this incredibly important and complex issue is Professor Catherine Meads. Catherine is a senior systematic reviewer at Anglia Ruskin University and has published numerous systematic reviews and health technology assessments. Catherine has a medical degree from Leicester University, a master's degree in information technology for management from Coventry University, and a master's degree in public health and a PhD in psychology from the University of Birmingham. Catherine has been conducting research into lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender health since 1992 and has published a number of groundbreaking papers in this area. She previously completed a best evidence review for Public Health England on health and healthcare experiences of UK sexual minority women and was a member of the UK Government Equalities Office LGBT Advisory Panel. So without further ado, welcome Catherine.
Thank you very much and thanks for inviting me.
We're more than happy to have you. I can't think of having someone better to discuss these issues with. So I'm going to start with quite a tricky one, Catherine, if that's okay. Is it possible to provide a broad overview of health inequality in LGBTQIA+ communities?
Yes, it is possible to provide a broad overview, but I think we'll start off by sort of listing what LGBTQIA actually means and where it's coming from. So we're talking about lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, queer, intersex, asexual, and anybody else who doesn't quite fit in with the heterosexual or straight or cisgender community. So it's a bunch of different communities who have some issues in common, some health issues in common, and some health issues which are separate and different. The health inequalities faced by one group may not be quite the same as the health inequalities faced by others. And there are health inequalities faced by, I'll just abbreviate it to LGBT because I actually mean all of these other ones as well, but it gets rather long. So I'll just say LGBT, but there are health inequalities. And as more and more research becomes available, we start to see where those health inequalities lie. I mean, did you want me to sort of list some of the things that we know about so far?
Yeah, I think firstly, you've raised the very important point of actually identifying all of those different groups and ones that, you know, may not even have the kind of official title that we try to bracket people under. And I think, as you say, it's important to highlight that. And yeah, I think it'd be nice if we have a little chat of maybe the broad overview of potential issues that the communities face. And then we can maybe delve into some of the more specifics.
Okay, well, one of the first health inequalities really is that not that much is known. The recording of sexual orientation, gender identity is rather poor so far. For example, there's the sexual orientation monitoring standard that has been set up for the NHS, but it's optional. It's not mandated, unlike the ethnicity one, which means that the evidence base is not coming through around sexual orientation that would actually help with some of the issues. That sexual orientation monitoring standard field is also supposed to be following through into the cancer registries because they use that field to indicate sexual orientation in the cancer registry. So if it's not completed in the trust, then the cancer registry don't get the data. So we're getting very poor data around sexual orientation and cancer. Now, there is no gender identity monitoring standard as yet in the NHS. So if the data on sexual orientation is poor, the data on gender identity is even worse. The bits that we have been able to work out what's going on have come from other sources. So we're talking about large cohort studies which have actually measured sexual orientation or gender identity, if we're lucky. For example, there's higher rates of mental health difficulties, common mental disorders, anxiety and depression, suicidality and so on, within, as far as we're aware, the whole of the LGBT community. But I think we might be touching on that a bit later. Going on to some of the physical health issues. Well, one of the publications I did fairly recently showed a higher rate of asthma in lesbians. Now, why that is so, we have absolutely no idea. There doesn't appear to be a higher rate of cardiovascular disease or hypertension or other smoking-related or stress-related conditions within the lesbian community, but there seems to be a higher rate of asthma. And that's a sort of a fruitful area for future research, we say. However, there is another sort of series of findings that actually makes a lot more sense. There is evidence to suggest that young girls who subsequently come out as lesbians may well have earlier heterosexual sex than their heterosexual counterparts. And we're not sure why they're exploring sex earlier, or more of them are exploring sex, but it may be something to do with higher rates of testosterone that are being found in lesbians compared to heterosexual women. There's also higher rates of teenage pregnancy in lesbians compared to heterosexual women. And they may not think that they are lesbian at the time of pregnancy, but they subsequently come out as lesbian. And it may be that they're trying to persuade themselves they're heterosexual. Or it could be to do with coercive sex, or it could be a whole range of other things, but we don't actually know why this is going on. But we've also got some evidence to show that there's higher rates of cervical abnormalities in lesbians compared to heterosexual women. And that's why the cancer registry data would be so useful, to find out whether these cervical abnormalities are then transferring across to cervical cancer. And also, we do know that lesbians tend not to go for cervical smears at anything like the rate of heterosexual women. And that could be for a variety of different reasons. But the upshot is that if you have higher risk of cervical cancer and lower rates of screening, the chances are that the lesbian community who do get cervical cancer are presenting later. And there's very little evidence around this at the moment, but this is what we suspect is going on.
I think, you know, there's so many important points that you've raised there, and so many things that instantly strike me as reflective, almost in a way, of medicine in the past, in that we know there is an issue, but we just don't understand why. And as you've clearly highlighted, this almost complete absence of evidence, you know, but not being an evidence of absence, you know, there's this, we just haven't researched these areas, and lots of interesting findings, but nothing quite almost actionable yet, because we've not even got to that next stage of saying, well, why has that happened? We're still kind of finding out little parts and little pieces. And I think the points you raise, for example, about asthma, I mean, that's a fascinating thing. Asthma affects so many people. But yeah, to look at that, you know, as you say, why in particular would lesbian women be suffering from higher rates of asthma than other groups? And surely that's something that's quite reversible, controllable in you know, in our with modern medicine.
Yeah.
And something that we could hopefully make a big impact in, given the amount of research that goes into asthma. So wow, I think, yeah, you've raised some really, really interesting points that I think highlight the struggles that there are in this area, and why there is still health inequality that exists. And it ties in quite, you know, interestingly into something that I've been thinking about. You know, we talk about this absence of research, this absence of evidence, not having utilized registers like we do for other things like ethnicity. What should, you know, the government or the NHS, what steps practically should be being taken to try and address this issue?
I don't know how many of your listeners will be able to remember back to when we started monitoring ethnicity in the 1990s. I was part of a group that was monitoring how well the NHS was actually recording ethnicity at the time. And I remember very clearly about complaints that it was racist, it was not useful, it was et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of people weren't completing the monitoring. But since then, it's become extremely useful for understanding how ethnicity impacts on health inequalities and the different experiences of different conditions and the health services and so on. Well, we're at that sort of stage now with sexual orientation, because we have a monitoring standard, but it's not being implemented. And if it was, we would get much, much better data about what's going on. And we're nowhere near there for gender identity. And that's what we really need, is these items of, I mean, they are very important items of personal information. Now, up till now, people have been saying, oh, no, we can't possibly ask about sexual orientation or gender identity. It's not right. It's too intrusive. It's too personal. However, the census in 2021 collected for the first time sexual orientation and gender reassignment. And for both of those fields, they were both optional questions, and well over 90% of the population answered those questions. So there is no good evidence to say that people won't fill in those questions. Quite the reverse is true. People will do it. So there's no excuse for not collecting it based on, oh, people won't like being asked. Because actually, what will happen is eventually it'll just become very commonplace and most people just tick a box and that'll be the end of the matter.
Yeah. And I think in a way, it's almost opening that conversation. You know, it's almost taking away it even being a taboo to think of sexual orientation, and all this is such an invasive question. I mean, you know, as we say, moving forward, it's not even going to be an issue, we hope, if society continues to change in the way that we would like.
Yeah.
But, you know, without taking these steps, and as you say, it's really interesting to compare it, for example, to ethnicity, where it was seen as a racist thing to do. And I wonder if, do you think that some of that part maybe comes from the fear of potentially how some of these communities have had interactions with healthcare in the past? There's maybe a mistrust there. Actually, perhaps there's a responsibility on us as healthcare professionals and as institutions to rebuild that trust that has perhaps been damaged in the past.
I think so. Well, for some people, yes, it has been tricky. You know, for older people, there was a law that was passed by the Tory government in late 80s called Section 28 of the Local Government Act. And that forbade the promotion of homosexuality as a tended family relationship. And as a result, an awful lot of people my age and older, and certainly children who are going through schools during that time, so it impacted on younger people as well. So it impacted on anybody who is sort of aged 40 or older now. And it made us feel that the government, the officialdom, the powers that be, was telling us that we shouldn't exist. So it made huge amounts of distrust of official power. Which I think for a lot of people, unless you really know that somebody is going to be positive, you assume that they aren't going to be positive. Now, if I have a health professional standing in front of me, hopefully they won't be in the slightest bit bothered about me being a lesbian or not. But I won't actually know unless they say. So I can't just assume that they will be okay about me. And I think a lot of people don't realise that. I think they just assume that I know I'm okay, so the person in front of me should also know that, but they won't necessarily know that. So you need some kind of open outward sign. Actually, you're going to be positive towards the LGBT community, and that would help a lot. But it needs to be a meaningful positivity where you've actually thought about some of the issues that might be prevalent for the people who are coming to access your service. You know, if I take my partner to a clinic appointment, is my partner going to be referred to as my sister? Or, you know, is my partnership actually going to be acknowledged? You know, if I'm a young trans person, will my pronouns be wrong, you know, on the official forms? Well, I mean, there's an example of a we haven't gone into screening yet, but what tends to happen with the current system is people who change gender tend to get invited for screening for body parts they don't have. So a trans woman might be invited for breast screening, but not prostate screening. So there's an example of a trans woman who tried to access a prostate screening clinic. And all the people in the clinic who were coming to be screened were obviously male, and she was feeling very, very difficult about actually being there anyway, and she didn't have a male friend or partner to take with her, so she had to go on her own. And then the clinic staff started addressing her as Mr. Smith, and that was very difficult for her as well. And the whole thing was just so hostile. I mean, it's a wonder that anybody actually goes for screening, given the difficulties that they're encountering when they go. I mean, when you have a cervical smear, the form says a woman's name. Now, if you're a trans man and you have a cervix, it doesn't apply. But why can't they put in patient's name? Why does it have to be woman's name? Anyways, there's all sorts of things that could be done that would make it much more inclusive and make people feel less not part of the system, not really fitting in. It's very difficult if you're, I mean, when you're unwell anyway, it's difficult to access the health services. And if you have the additional whammy of not really fitting in either, it just makes life so difficult.
It's really interesting what you say about processes that, you know, as someone who's cisgendered, you take as such a basic process. You know, it's not something that's even a complex aspect of healthcare or healthcare interaction, and it's not meant to be. And yet all of these barriers are being put up, and sadly, you know, people are perhaps not even aware of them, and you know that it's not even crossed their mind, and the fact that that's not even become a thought is so disheartening from anyone who is trying to access that community, access that service, you know, and doesn't fit the you know, the classic cisgendered box that you would expect to be accessing it. And I mean, I just, you know, some things that I found that I think tie in with that is, you know, from a YouGov poll, of they looked at it and said that, you know, one in seven LGBT people had avoided treatment for fear of discrimination, and one in four had witnessed discriminatory or negative remarks against LGBT people by healthcare staff. And so much of it talks, you know, what you've said about having that positive, you know, actually outwardly positive interaction, not just, oh, we tolerate and we're going to try and accept this, an actual positive representation. And you briefly kind of alluded to things, simple things like changing titles, so it's not Mr. or Mrs., you know, it's just patient name and things like that, you know. Are there any other kind of steps that you see institutions or even individual trusts could take quite easily as something to just help address some of these barriers?
I think fundamentally healthcare staff need to have training in this area, because some recent research has shown that up to 80% of healthcare professionals have absolutely no training in LGBT health or healthcare issues. And so you're trying to cope with an area where you've never really had the opportunity to explore the issues in a training situation. And I don't think that's really fair. The other thing I was going to point out is that we have a very multicultural healthcare training workforce. Now, if you are coming from a culture where homosexuality, for example, is seen as a criminal act, and then you come to the NHS, it's rather difficult to take on board the whole new set of ethics and equality requirements without cultural awareness training. But my guess is that this kind of thing is not actually covered for new staff when they are starting work in the NHS. And the reason why I said that is because I was recently teaching a group of MPH students around LGBT health inequalities. And one of the people there, who was actually a NHS staff member, put his hand up and said, "Well, homosexuality is a mental illness, isn't it?" And I was going, "No, it's a normal variation society." 30 years ago, it was delisted as a mental illness. But if you come from a culture where it's still considered to be a mental illness, you're going to bring that with you. So when LGBT people are saying they're hearing health staff make derogatory comments and things like that, part of it is lack of training, and part of it might be cultural differences. They're just not aware. that the person in front of them might actually be LGBT, because you can't tell. You know, you cannot tell for certain whether somebody's trans. You cannot say whether they're a sexual minority or not until they out themselves to you. So, and yeah. I think there's a lot of assumptions around what trans people look like, and what lesbians look like, what gay men look like, and so on. And we don't fit those stereotypes.
No, and I think, you know, a whole issue within itself as well is, as you say, A, this is not something you can look at and know what someone is. But B, also, you know, there's the process of that person having to out themselves to healthcare professionals as well.
Yeah.
Which within itself carries its own baggage of, you know, do people feel like they need to or have to? I think, you know, I read that people often find it the struggle of they hear healthcare professionals outing them to other healthcare professionals when, you know, they can't see that there's any relevance there, but it's not even kind of considered anything that you know, the healthcare professionals are discussing it amongst themselves. And as you say, I mean, you know, talking personally from my experience in medicine, you know, I never had any specific focused training on, you know, on these communities, on the issues they face, on the specific challenges and, you know, specific ways that we should be interacting as a profession. And I think, in as always, as an issue, education is clearly just something that is lacking and we need more of. I want to just pivot slightly to something we touched on earlier, but I think it's a really important issue that we discuss. And that's that mental health is clearly a huge aspect of health inequality for the LGBT community. We know that sadly in all communities, let alone LGBT, it's under-resourced and under-researched. What are the challenges facing the community and what kind of steps need to be taken to help address these?
Well, we know that there are higher rates of mental health difficulties in the LGBT community. And we think that part of the reason why is to do with the minority stress theory, which is all about having to cope with being part of a minority. So you're living in an environment where there are all sorts of factors that make you think you don't quite fit in. So you're feeling part of an identity minority, and you can express some prejudice, violence, discrimination, things like microaggressions. You might feel that you have to conceal who you are quite often. You know, at work, you may not be out. You may not be able to talk about your partner or the issues that you're having at the moment. You may not have as much social support as other people. And all of this stuff can impact on your mental health. And then, say you go for counselling, there is some research looking at the IAPT service. Is set up really for heterosexual counselling. And when you ask lesbians whether it works as well for them, and actually it doesn't. The outcomes are not as good for lesbians trying to access IAPT services compared to heterosexual women. There isn't as much information around gay men and the IAPT service, but it sort of begs the point about, you know, why expect an intervention that is tailored towards the heterosexual community to work for the sexual minority community? Why expect a counselling service that's tailored towards the cisgendered community to work for the trans community? It's not going to. And so the IAPT service, the other counselling services, they also need to take on board that there are issues that they need to deal with within the LGBT community that need to be addressed straight away. So there, you know, there's stories coming from young people accessing counselling where in 2 years, a counsellor has never said to the person, it's OK to be gay. And that message was so important to that young person. And, you know, if you never actually hear that, it can make life very difficult, because everybody in the LGBT community has some kind of internalized homophobia or transphobia that they are struggling with themselves. And if you have a counsellor who never really acknowledges that those internalized messages are going on at the same time as trying to deal with all the other stresses and strains in life, it, it makes your life very difficult and makes it harder to actually respond to the counselling that you're getting. I suppose the best way to illustrate it would be to ask a straight person to go into a gay bar and not let on that they're straight. You know, you'd be standing there going, oh, what do I say? What do I do? How do I work? How, you know, oh, there's all these people around me. I don't fit in. And it's a bit like that. And then you're trying to cope with that as well as the other difficulties that are going on.
Yeah. And trying to be, you know, as functional and fully functional as you're meant to be on the outside, yeah, whilst dealing with all of that. And as you say, a lot of the time, people feeling very isolated anyway.
Yeah.
So that when they're accessing these services, which they're seeing as hopefully part of a solution, if even when accessing that service, they still feel isolated and don't feel like they're being given a voice or a voice that represents them, then I can only imagine that it adds to that weight of isolation. And I think, you know, again, from a few bits of the things that I read that really shocked me, with when the government, you know, performed their survey in 2017 and made the LGBT action plan in 2018, you know, over, I think it was 108,000 respondents, 51% had tried to access mental health services. It's a huge, huge problem. You know, if you compared that to any other community or any other group, if there was over 50% trying to access something, we'd be calling this a crisis. Yeah. We'd be saying action needs to be taken right now. This is, you know, this is a crisis in front of our eyes that's developing.
Yeah.
So I think it's, you know, it's highlighting just how large these experiences and are for these communities. Yes, we know that mental health is a big issue throughout the population, but in particular for, you know, for the LGBT community, it is getting to crisis point of how many people are having to access these services. And, you know, I saw a really, you know, horrifying stat of half of LGBT people who are asked between 18 and 24, 52% had thought about taking their own life in the last year. And it does feel like, as you say, we've created so much in our society that's geared towards the normality, the one way of being, that actually we don't have anything that is bespoke or actually designed for the communities who need help the most.
Yeah.
And I think what that moves us on to is we need to think about, you know, what do physicians need to know when it comes to addressing health inequality in the LGBT community? Even, for example, when we've spoken about education being an issue, but even if we think about the basics around sexual orientation and gender identity, what does the person who is on the front line having interactions with LGBT people potentially every day that they won't be aware of, what do they need to know?
Well, they need to know that any person in front of them may be LGBT, in which case they may need to ask them if it's relevant to their treatment, what issues, you know, if it's a trans person, they may need to ask them about what treatments they've had in the past. They might need to know what hormones they're on and the interactions between the hormones and the other treatments that they may be on. If they have, you know, potentially a cancer, if it's a hormone-related cancer, they may need to access specialist advice about how to tailor the treatment for that person, in which case they could contact the gender identity clinic for advice about how best to combine the hormones or the other treatments that the person is on with the cancer treatment that's planned. There's a wide range of things that people need to know about, and once they know about it, then they can tailor their response to that individual based on what that particular person needs. But if they don't have the information to hand in advance, it's very difficult to quite say exactly what each individual patient will need. It's being aware that there are health inequalities, there are LGBT people, they have special needs in some directions but not in others, and not making presumptions about who you've got in front of you.
That is, I think, in and of itself such an important thing. And I think even that step, as you say, of if it is relevant, finding out those past treatments, those past potential therapies. And I actually think potentially a next step that as healthcare professionals we need to be better at, because, you know, often we come across as, you know, slightly interrogational. And I think especially when we're dealing with issues such as, you know, such as gender identity, sexual orientation, I think actually it's more, it's very important that as healthcare professionals, we give a context to why we're asking a question.
Yes.
And I think often we're so used to, and part of this is the pressures of working, we just rattle through our questions to get the information that we need.
Yeah.
But I think recognizing the impact that can have on that person in front of you, that patient, making sure that your care is, you know, focused towards them, but actually providing the context of why you're asking these questions. You're not just being unnecessarily invasive. Mm. You're asking a question because you think it has complete relevance to their treatment at the moment, and it will help you, you know, treat them in the best way possible, but providing that information so it doesn't seem like you're just randomly asking them some questions.
Can I give you an example? So this happens to a lot of lesbians when you go for a cervical smear. You get a smear nurse asking you, are you having sex? And I might respond, yes. And they say, well, are you trying for a baby? I might say, no. And then they might say, are you using contraception? I might say, no. And then they'll say, well, you're being very irresponsible if you think you can have sex without, you know, being, having the risk of pregnancy. And I'm sitting there going, what on earth do I do now? She has just made this presumption straight away that I'm heterosexual. And if I come out to her, she's the next, her next action is sticking a speculum up my vagina, which would not be terribly comfortable anyway. If I don't come out to her, she's got completely the wrong end of the stick. And it's put me in a complete difficulty. Now, if that smear nurse had said to me, are you having sex with a man? Instead of saying, are you having sex? The whole difficulty would have gone away completely. But because she just assumed that every sex is heterosexual sex, she didn't say, are you having sex with a man? And it's that understanding of why, you know, sexual minorities are having difficulties is really important to explore when you're training health professionals, really.
That language that we use has such a potential impact, but is also such an easy thing for us to address and change, that, as you say, if the basic education was out there as it should be and embedded potentially into curriculum as people go through university, people would avoid creating those terrible situations for patients with such a simple change. And we may, maybe we don't even appreciate the power of something as small as that, and the power that our actions have.
If you remember, I mentioned that quite a lot fewer lesbians go for cervical smears. And this scenario is one of the reasons why they don't go. And then the knock-on effects of cervical cancer changes. You know, it's directly affecting people's health and their experience of healthcare.
And when you frame it like that, you know, I think a lot of people, when they think of health inequality in any population, they think, what power do I have as one individual to make any kind of impact into these, you know, massive issues that need government implementation, or they need big systemic change and things like that. That is a perfect example of the power that one person can have, and the power that your one interaction can have of actually affecting change. Thinking about your interaction, thinking about that language you're using, thinking about just being an inclusive practitioner and ensuring that your patients feel comfortable and that you're treating them in the correct way. And that would have a direct impact potentially on health inequality within that community. Just want to try and touch on something that we did speak a little bit right kind of at the beginning about, and that was, you highlighted so importantly how there are differences and big differences within communities and potential challenges that people face. And given that we need to respect these differences and challenges, but we're still trying to tackle this, you know, this massive overall health inequalities that are shared by some of the LGBT community, what can we do to still respect individuals or still look for those kind of more individual challenges as opposed to just the large community problems?
Well, I think the main thing is to ask the individual how their identity and societal part affects what's happening for them. You know, when you're taking a history and examination of a patient, this is a vital part of their social history. And asking people in an open way, you know, what's important to you, you know, who are important to you, and you know, what pronouns do you use, you know, have we got your name right, etc.
I mean, they're all such simple things when they're said, aren't they? I think that's the really interesting thing. None of these are difficult things to do. And yet clearly what we see from you know, the evidence we have out there, even though yes, it comes from a few years ago, and if I can only imagine things have probably got worse during COVID, as a lot of parameters did get worse during COVID that we haven't yet found the results of.
Do you realise that the government never collected any COVID statistics around sexual orientation or gender identity? There's nothing coming from the Office for National Statistics or anything. So there's still no official statistics about whether there was higher rates of incidents, hospitalisations, deaths by sexual orientation or gender identity. And I think that's another aspect to the health inequalities, is that the complete lack of data. And the Office for National Statistics was asked several times to furnish that data, and they kept saying, oh no, we can't. But actually what they would have needed to do was join two data sets together and make an estimate using that, and they never did it because the political will was not there.
And I think again it highlights just another one of the huge challenges faced by the LGBT community, and how much work there is still to do to try and bring some equality there. Because I think we often, especially, you know, in 2023, it's very easy to fool yourself to thinking, well, look how much better society is than it was. But that doesn't hide away from the fact that there are still huge inequalities there that we are just failing to address and still need sorted out. And you brought that really nicely, roundly back to right what you said at the beginning, which is we need to have more data, and we need to have more data so that we can actually start addressing these problems and trying to get to the root cause of what's going on within these communities. Because without even knowing that, how can we hope to address any of the problems?
Agree.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Catherine. That's been an incredible discussion about an unbelievably important topic. And I hope that everyone listening now has more of an idea about health inequalities faced by the LGBT community and practical things that they can do as a practitioner, a clinician, to ensure that they are helping to try and address health inequality in the LGBT community. Please, if you have any feedback or any further questions, get in touch via our submission page on the website, and we will also put a list of resources there if anyone has any further questions that they want to investigate further, some useful starting points to look at for health inequality in LGBT communities. So thank you everyone for listening, and see you next time.